Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we learn about Illinois' first state capital, Kaskaskia. Once a burgeoning town, it's been nearly lost to history and the Mississippi River. We'll talk with authors of a book on Kaskaskia. Also, Catholic churches are seeing a rejuvenation among parishioners. Many credit the American Pope Leo with improving the popularity of the church. We'll talk with one Illinois bishop. One of Chicago's oldest black churches sees new ways to help its community. We'll have a report. Also, bicycles were once a major industry in Illinois. We'll bring you the history of bicycle manufacturing. And Illinois lawmakers are considering more regulation on insurance companies, including their ability to raise rates on customers. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, you know, Springfield is the capital of Illinois. It's actually the third location to have that title. Vandalia was the previous state capital, and the first was located in Kaskaskia, a town that barely exists today. What happened to a place that was once an economic and political hub? David McDonald and Rain Waters wrote the book, Kaskaskia, the Lost Capital of Illinois. Back in 2019, Sam Dunklaw talked with the authors. Today we revisit that conversation.
David, this town of Kaskaskia, for our listeners who maybe have never been there, can't really place it on a map, where is it? And in your opinions, why is this little town so important to Illinois history?
Well, it's about 65 miles south of St. Louis, but of course on the Illinois side of the river. It was founded when some Jesuits and the Kaskaskia Indians settled there in 1703. From that time until about 1830, it was the largest settlement anywhere around. It was the largest of the French villages. It was our territorial capital. It was our first state capital. And then after 1820, it began to decline. And eventually it was swept away by the Mississippi and now doesn't exist at all. Although there is a town called Kaskaskia, but that's New Kaskaskia, 3 miles away from the site of Old Kaskaskia.
Why did they choose to settle there, and why was it valuable to those that did?
Well, it was very, very rich bottom soil, wonderful for grazing animals, wonderful for raising crops, but it also had problems. It floods quite regularly and sometimes disastrously.
And that is sort of where things start to come apart. The book also mentions the town suffered from inept rule from both the British when they took over, and then the Americans when they took over from the British. Can you give any examples of that and whether or not it contributed to sort of the beginning of the end for Kaskaskia?
Well, between 1765, when the British moved in, and 1778, when George Rogers Clark conquered the area for the new American Republic, the British had 9 different governors, all military men, none skilled in civil administration, several of them notably corrupt, others perhaps well-meaning, but totally inept. And then George Rogers Clark came in, and he was fairly well greeted by the French. And then when they pulled out in the early 1780s, they didn't leave much of anything behind, and there was virtual anarchy for some years. So that left a period from 1765 to 1790 that discouraged many people, and even under the American rule, many left.
And during this time, there's a lot of things going on. What are the sort of things that Kaskaskia had to contend with?
Well, a tornado ripped through in, I think it was 1812. The New Madrid earthquakes hit Kaskaskia very hard. There were 4 or 5 years of successive crop failures in the 1880s. And remember, these people are not only growing for the market, they're growing subsistence food. So there was hunger in the land during those years.
The town is eventually swallowed whole by the Mississippi. Can you describe that?
The banks of the Mississippi had been largely denuded of trees in order to feed the boilers, the sidewheel steamers. So the river grew wider, shallower, and began to erode away the banks. And then finally it began to change course. and ate into the narrow neck of land between Kaskaskia. One side was limestone bluffs. They were not about to be eroded away. And the other side on which Kaskaskia stood was soft alluvial soil. So the town succumbed, and nothing could be done to save it.
Rain, I want to turn to your work on the curse of the town. The both of you write in the book that it is certainly interesting coincidence that the number of misfortunes befall this town to where, quote, even a reasonable person could be forgiven for thinking that the town was cursed.
Exactly. That's what fascinated me about it. It's superstitious, I guess, but we all have our little superstitions, and it's very easy to believe in those things, you know, and the town maybe in a sense it was cursed.
How did that begin? And can you differentiate for us the facts of sort of what led people to believe that versus the fiction that was created?
When things were going wrong in the 1780s, a local priest wrote something of a lament about the sad state of the town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And later on, a portion of that lament, just a line or two, was taken by some people as a curse rather than a complaint.
Yeah. Well, you have to think about the location of Kaskaskia. You've got tornadoes, floods, famine, disease. It was not the greatest of location in spite of the soil being so wonderful. There was just a lot happened there. And so his complaints were kind of valid.
The curse, as it is told in 1892 and in 1902, are complete fictions loaded with all sorts of anachronisms. For instance, sometime before 1712, an Indian and French couple are supposedly fleeing to St. Louis, which wasn't founded until 1764.
I think they attempted to take off, and
yeah,
the young man was taken by the father
and
put on that boat, we'll call it a raft, and set off on the Mississippi, and for dead, just sent him off. And as he's floating away, he curses the town. I'm laughing. It's not funny, but it is funny. I mean, you know, because that's the part that's another part that's made up.
And there are many other historical blunders in these stories that show that they are fiction.
They kind of took the curse and romanced it up a bit.
Quite a bit.
As we went on into the early part of the 19th century, Kaskaskia becomes the territorial capital and then the state capital for Illinois. But then it loses its place as the state capital to Vandalia. What happened there?
Well, there were a number of talking points about why they wanted to move the capital. They said, oh, Kaskaskia floods too regularly and they have to use rented buildings there. But the real reason was that a number of the state legislators had bought land around Vandalia cheaply and expected to make a killing when the capital moved there and people moved following the capital. I'm kind of pleased to say that Vandalia never really took off all that much, and they didn't make the killing they had hoped. But it was sort of a corrupt political deal that led to the movement.
It was probably only convenient that Kaskaskia did, in fact, flood as much as it did.
Well, it was the beginning of a long tradition of Illinois politics.
What are you two most proud about, having finished this three-year-long work?
Well, I think gathering the photos and trying to bring together a connected narrative from so many different sources.
You know, I grew up in a military family. I've lived all over the U.S. I was born in North Carolina and lived there mostly. But I guess I'm from Illinois now. And this is history, part of my history to me. This is important.
The authors David McDonald and Rain Waters, they wrote the book Kaskaskia, The Lost Capital of Illinois. The Obama Presidential Center in Chicago is set to open in June, and tickets are now going on sale. The general public can purchase them starting May 6th and book a date to visit. Admission, $30 for adults, $23 for children ages 3 through 11. Those under 2 get in for free. The museum is also free on Tuesdays with proof of Illinois residency. Most of the center's campus is also free and open to the public, including gardens, walking trails, a playground, and newly commissioned artworks. A recent New York Times report indicates many Catholic churches across the country are seeing more people in the pews after years of declining attendance. That decline prompted a major church reorganization and consolidation of parishes. Louis Tilke is bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Peoria, which oversees close to 100 churches in central Illinois. He said the number of people participating in First Communion and confirmation ceremonies this year has doubled. In an interview with Eric Stock, Tilke says there seem to be several reasons for the resurgence, and the new Chicago-born Pope is just one of them.
There's certainly, I think, a great spirit, This is all the work of the Holy Spirit working through people's lives individually. You know, we have to give credit where credit's due. It's not something that I'm doing as bishop or priest or religious. It's God working in people's lives, and they're discovering their hunger for the Lord. And, you know, as we look around at the world around us, it's easy to see all the problems and conflicts and chaos that exist in the world. And I think people are hungering for some stability, for some grounding, and for some truth. And of course, you can find all of that if you have a relationship with the Lord.
It was nearly a year ago that Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost, the Chicago native, was named the first ever pope from North America. How much impact does that have, the fact that he's from Chicago, that has got more people back to the church in this part of the country?
I think it sparked a lot of curiosity, first on a personal level, like, who is this guy? And, you know, I was a priest of Chicago for 24 years before becoming bishop of Peoria. So everybody asks if I know Pope Leo. Did I know him beforehand? You know, I like to say that I was born in the town next door to where Pope Leo lived as a young boy, and his favorite pizza place is a favorite pizza place of mine. I grew up eating Aurelio's Pizza, you know, but I never met the man previously, but everybody wanted to know, you know, and so that initial curiosity of about who this man is leads to, you know, the bigger question, like, if you look at his life, wow, this man is giving his life up for the church, for the mission of Jesus. He would be went on mission to Peru. You look and you see and you find inspiration in what somebody else is doing and how they're living their life of faith. And that initial spark of curiosity all of a sudden becomes more, you know, embers of faith that are dwelling up within us.
And Pope Leo's messaging seems similar to that of his predecessor, Pope Francis. On Palm Sunday, he said, God rejects war, whom no one can use to justify war. This at a time when wars continue across the globe, in Ukraine, in Iran. Who do you believe that message was for?
I'd say there's two dual purpose to that message. You know, again, speaking, the Pope speaks, you know, to the world. And so the famous messages that a Pope gives on Christmas and Easter, you know, to the city and to the world, right? So I think that, you know, Pope Leo is speaking out against war, is speaking to the world community, challenging all the nations of the world to seek ways of peace and justice, to end violence and war. But it's also, you know, a reality that we live in a country that is now in conflict in Iran. And, you know, so I we would be foolish not to hear that as a message that we need to hear and take to heart in our own country and ask the questions of whether or not a conflict such as the one we're in with Iran is a just conflict. So it's a message both local and universal, especially when you're speaking as the vicar of Christ and the successor of Peter, you're trying to call the entire world to that harmony and justice that and peace that we should all live in.
As we continue with Bishop Louis Tilke from the Peoria Catholic Diocese, we had talked about the church growing. How much of this is fueled by young people in particular?
Well, I think young people are in a particular, at this point in time, a group of a generation of individuals who are returning to asking those bigger questions. You know, we've lived through a pandemic that shut down the world, and we lost so many lives, and so many things changed because of coming through the COVID pandemic back in 2020. It shapes their thinking. You know, I don't want to live in isolation. I don't want to live separated from people that I love. I want people in my life, right? You know, a screen on a cell phone or a computer, it does not bring the same experience of actually being in a room with somebody and having a conversation with them. And, you know, the tactile experience of somebody shaking a hand or giving a hug. You know, so I think young people are certainly hungry for connection and, you know, certainly seeking ways to find that in a good and healthy way, which is, of course, to build good relationships.
This growth in the Catholic Church comes at a time when churches within the Peoria Diocese have been going through a years-long reorganization to account for shifting populations, some declining numbers. Does this cause you to rethink that? Does that change the prospects long term for what the Catholic Church will look like?
It doesn't cause me to rethink it. Part of the reason that we went through that years-long process of self-examination and reorganization of our parish structures, we want to be more missional. We want to go out and encounter people in bring them into a relationship with Jesus and the church. And if we're spending all of our time and energy and resources maintaining old structures that are no longer, you know, serving that mission that we're given by the Lord to go out, we're not living up to our calling as disciples of Jesus.
That's the Bishop Louis Tilke of the Catholic Diocese of Peoria. He spoke with Eric Stock. Later in the show, we'll hear how one of Chicago's oldest black churches has a history of helping its community, and how a new phase is following in that tradition. That's ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Bicycles were once a top export from the state of Illinois. According to a new book, manufacturing centers in Peoria and Chicago made two-thirds of all bicycles sold in the U.S. in 1898. That changed a lot, though, over 160 years, in a series of booms and busts. Chris Sweet is a librarian at Illinois Wesleyan University. He's author of the book A History of Bicycling in Illinois from U of I Press. In this interview with Charlie Schlinker, Sweet says, in the 1890s, bicycling was a national activity second only to baseball. It was brought on by the entry of so-called safety bikes with two wheels about the same size.
Once that design changed, kids were riding, women were riding, men were still riding in huge numbers, and it became the socially elite thing to do. So bicycling became incredibly popular, 1890 to about 1900.
And when did it crash, and why?
The easy answer that people jump to, right, is the rise of the automobile. But when you start to look into how many automobiles were actually being produced, it gets a little bit more complicated. So my opinion, it really was, it became no longer the socially cool, popular thing to do. The bikes became cheaper. Anybody could get on one. It kind of lost its allure for some, and they moved on to the next fad, which was motorcycles, then automobiles.
So how much did it decline in cost?
About early 1890s, one of those safety bicycles, you would be looking at about $100 in, you know, 1890s dollars. Sears and Montgomery Ward got into the business and drove prices down like crazy. You get one for about $20 by 1900.
So democratizing the availability killed it off.
Yes. Once the average shop worker, minorities could get on there, all of a sudden it became less desirable to show that you were, you know, to as a status symbol.
You make the case in the book that Illinois was a big center, big hub. Why?
A number of reasons, some that you would expect and some that you might not expect. So Chicago is already a manufacturing center. They were very good at building all sorts of things, factories could flip in a matter of a month and move from making like an agricultural implement to making bikes. And some did choose to do that. So there was already the infrastructure there and the know-how about how to build things. That was part of it. Easy access to raw materials, right? You need a lot of iron ore shipping down from the Upper Peninsula. Now for bicycles themselves, one that people might not think of is simple topography, especially around Chicago, very flat. And they also invested in better roads than most places. So those two things together, right? Early bikes only had one gear. So if you were in a mountainous area, they were not very much fun to ride. But if you were in the Chicago area, you could get away with a single gear and have a pretty enjoyable experience. And then this investment in roads, Chicago did a lot of woodblock roads, early types of asphalt, and that made the riding experience better. Prior to 1890, roads in the United States were haphazard. Generally, all rural roads were the responsible of the adjacent landowners. So if a farmer felt like investing in the road next to his property and keeping it up, he could. But they, you know, very deep ruts, unpassable sometimes in the spring. And cyclists were so passionate about getting out there and getting people to be able to ride into some of these rural areas, they started lobbying both the federal government and state governments to build better roads. Bicyclists drove what is known as the Good Road Movement, and the bicycle companies invested in this. They lobbied Congress in order to have the first highway administration.
We're talking with Chris Sweet, the author of A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts. What are some Illinois firsts in bicycling?
There was this thing called U.S. Census of Manufacturers, and this was a gold mine when I found it. It reported to the U.S. Census Bureau the output of different factories. We were indeed the first and the biggest as far as manufacturing bicycles, so that was a big one. There's a number of ones that people would be maybe surprised about. The first banked bicycle track. Another one that will make a little splash in the very small bicycle historian world is that Illinois was the location of the first six-day bicycle race. Six-day races are originally just what it sounds like. The cyclists, as individuals, rode as far as they could over the course of 6 days. Sometimes there were teams. Sometimes it was done as an individual. The first one of these occurred in Chicago. It was indoors, so you can imagine riding inside on a very tiny track and just going and going for days. They became big spectator sports.
Illinois and Chicago also had the first pneumatic tires and the first bikes with multiple gears. Peoria had the Luthi Bicycle Company, and it had a couple of other bicycle significant items in it. And Bloomington had a bicycle company. Why Central Illinois?
Peoria was the second biggest city in the state behind Chicago, and in the later 1800s, they weren't all that far behind Chicago. People kind of forget how big Peoria was in relationship to Chicago. The reasons are much the same as the ones I said earlier for Chicago. Peoria had a big manufacturing hub already in existence, so they were able to move some of these factories very quickly into bicycle manufacturing. In some cases, it was a side business for like a watch company. One of the interesting that Peoria was known for is what was called high art bicycles. They went after the high end of the market, so like very intricate filigree work on the bicycle lugs, the pieces that connect the frames together. Lots of nickel plating on the bikes was as a way to kind of stand out from everybody else.
So those were Luthi Bikes and Rouse Hazard and Company.
Sure, those are the big ones from Peoria.
In what ways did bicycling facilitate or inflect social change?
Women and gender issues would be first and foremost. During this boom period of the 1890s, it kind of aligns, right, with the progressive era when women's rights and suffrage were big topics, as well as prohibition. This is all wrapped up in sort of the progressive era. Bicycles come along at the same time, and women really embrace the bicycle as a means of emancipation. Many men really wanted to bring women on along on the rides, right? To involve them in some of the club rides, to get their girlfriends and their spouses out riding. But you know what doesn't work very well when you're trying to ride a bicycle is these big Victorian skirts, right? This drove dress reform, the bloomer style of dress, a split skirt essentially, but it allowed women to ride and to hopefully keep those the dresses out of the chains. So this is all part of the bicycle story.
How did the development of bicycle technologies affect the early automobile industry? You spend some time in the book on the Duryea brothers of Canton and Peoria.
If you haven't heard that name before, it's well worth looking up. The Duryea brothers, it was Charles and Frank, they both were involved in the bicycle industry to start with. Charles has a number of patents, quite a few patents to his name, and also built some bicycles in Peoria. But the reason that we know them is not their bicycle history. It is certainly their connection to the American automobile industry. The Duryea brothers had the first mass-produced automobile is their claim to fame. So their story is kind of exemplary, right? A lot of people went directly from bicycle manufacturing to automobile manufacturing. So some of the technologies are very straight transfer from bikes to cars. Ball bearings were developed for bicycles. Differential gearing was developed by bicycle manufacturers. Some manufacturing processes, if they weren't developed, they were perfected. So industrial stamping, using great big presses and drills to do mass production of pieces of bicycles, that led directly to some of the early assembly lines for automobiles. We mentioned pneumatic tires that give some cushioning and traction that was developed by bicyclists and some of the same tires. Bicycle tires were used on some of the early cars. This line is incredibly direct.
Chris Sweet is author of the book, A History of Bicycling in Illinois, 160 Years of Booms and Busts. He spoke with Charlie Schlinker. Animal agriculture is under scrutiny by consumers. People who eat meat are thinking more about the environmental impact and the welfare of cattle and other livestock from farm to processing plant. As Hope Kerwin with Harvest Public Media reports, a university in Wisconsin is hoping a new augmented reality tool will give people working with livestock a better understanding of a cow's perspective.
Keeping a cow's stress levels low leads to better meat quality and milk production. There are fewer injuries on a farm when cattle are calm, and it's viewed as part of the ethical way to care for livestock. But identifying potential sources of stress requires an understanding of how cows see the world. That's according to Ashlyn Kirk from the Humane Handling Institute at the University of Wisconsin River Falls.
When you are designing facilities for animals, you're trying to imagine how they would experience it, but it really, you don't know unless you see it like they would.
It's why the Institute is now using augmented reality to let farmers and meat processing staff see their facilities through a cow's eyes. Kirk let me try out the new tool at UW River Falls Meat Plant. It starts with a black safety helmet that has a double-sided camera mounted to the front.
So this camera allows you to see essentially 360 degrees around you, except there will be a blind spot directly behind you, much like cattle have.
I tighten the helmet on my head and pull on the virtual reality goggles. The screen comes to life, and all of a sudden, I've got cattle vision.
Wow, it's like seeing through a tube, like only what's right in front of me is what's in focus versus everything on the side is very blurry.
That's because a cow's eyes are on the sides of their head, so much of what they see is only through one eye. They also see in shades of blue and yellow, what's called dichromatic vision. A red jacket or safety vest looks brown while wearing the goggles. Next, Kirk opens the door to the outside loading dock.
Wow, I cannot see anything at all. It is so bright.
So it takes a little bit longer for cattle's eyes to adjust?
It takes at least 15 seconds for the goggles to transition to the sunny day outside. There's another lag when I move back into the darker building. UW River Falls is the first organization in the U.S. to use the augmented reality program, which was developed by German software company Computer Output Management. Agricultural engineer Benito Weise came up with the idea after years of trying to use pictures to teach people about how different the world is for their animals. He says it's easy to miscommunicate with cattle.
Often we make mistakes and we don't understand. Why does he stop here? Why does he go? Doesn't he go on? And maybe he's getting aggressive.
In addition to cows, the German company has created pig vision and horse vision, and they're working on sheep next. They've sold or rented the system to customers across Europe, and the company in charge of meat production for McDonald's. The tool could help major restaurant and food companies respond to growing attention placed on animal welfare. Ron Gill, livestock extension specialist at Texas A&M University, says consumers are thinking more about the treatment of the animals they're eating.
So if we can manage the welfare of the cattle better through using these kind of technologies, I think it's a win for everybody.
He says it requires building empathy for livestock and creating systems that make sense for their natural instincts. In Wisconsin, Kirk says the processing plant staff and farmers who have tried out the technology leave with new ideas about how to make their facilities better suited for cows.
There's a lot of, like, oh, I've been doing this for a long time, but I never realized why it was like this. Like, why cattle stop at a certain part.
That might mean installing different lights to ease their transition from trailer to barn, or simply changing the color of safety vests to make cattle feel more comfortable around the people handling them. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
State lawmakers tried and failed last year to regulate homeowners' insurance rates, and they're trying again. But now, some in the Illinois legislature also want control over auto insurance rates. Evan Holden reports that measure passed the Illinois House and is awaiting a vote in the state Senate.
The bill makes insurance companies disclose rate increases 60 days before they do it and will allow the Illinois Department of Insurance to deny rate increases if they find them excessive. And it can require insurance companies to issue rebates to customers. Insurance companies say the bill might increase rates and make the Illinois insurance market less competitive, because insurance companies will leave. Illinois is the only state that does not regulate insurance rates. This comes after a failed attempt to pass a similar bill that Governor J.B. Pritzker supported. Democratic State Representative Sharon Chung, representing Bloomington Normal, voted against both efforts to regulate insurance rates. She says the latest bill is vague on what constitutes an unfair rate increase and what information insurance companies need to file to the Illinois Department of Insurance. Chung says that now the bill is going to the Senate floor, it means her colleagues don't want to compromise with insurance companies.
The way I've sort of seen it is that because they sort of put this bill out there and at one point really weren't willing to sort of negotiate or compromise with industry or even talk to them, it seems like some of that trust has been kind of broken.
Chung proposed a bill earlier in the session which would have given the state the authority to approve insurance rates but would not allow for customer rebates. She wanted that to be a conversation starter between lawmakers and insurance companies. Chung says the broken trust between insurance companies and the Department of Insurance is why insurance companies want more clarity with definitions. Chung did not say what those definitions should be. Chung adds the bill might not be able to stop rate increases.
That's kind of one of the reasons why I sort of have been fighting against this bill, because I just don't think it's going to do what people think that it's going to do.
Chung says some of the rate increases are due to severe weather in Illinois, including more tornadoes. Chung says Illinois should look at other causes that are driving up rates, like the storm chaser scam. Storm chasers are people who come directly after a storm saying they can repair people's houses, but these repairs are not covered by insurance. Sean Kevlin, CEO of Insurance Information Institute, says there are multiple drivers that increase insurance rates.
You know, we had an extraordinary amount of inflation coming out of COVID. Those inflation rates are now normalizing into a level that, you know, is much more manageable, 2-3%.
Kevlin says as inflation slows, it makes more money available for claims and provides discounts. Kevlin says the 60-day notice before raising premiums that are above 10% could increase rates more because companies cannot adapt as quickly to changing markets.
The longer that you apply approval timing, it can have negative impacts.
Kevlin says Illinois should focus more on helping people reinforce their homes and continue looking into other areas to decrease rates. Illinois State Senator Michael Hastings, a Democrat representing a suburb of Chicago, supports new rate regulations. He says the bill might not decrease insurance rates, but could slow rate increases.
We have to do our best to make sure that the quality of life that they have, number one, is good, and that it's affordable. And by passing this law, at least the law I passed over, was solely to protect our homeowners and our residents across Illinois.
State Farm and Country Financial are both opposed to rate regulations outlined in the bill. State Farm says the bill might undermine rate predictability, market stability, and reduce competition for home and auto insurance. I'm Evan Holden.
We'll return with more of Statewide right after this. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Founded in 1850, the Olivet Baptist Church is one of Chicago's oldest black churches. By the early part of last century, it became a model for how a church could serve black migrants coming north during the Great Migration. The church went beyond spirituality and supported their everyday needs for survival. Nicole Janine Johnson reports on Olivet's legacy and its quest to reclaim its role as a community-minded church.
More than 50 years after emancipation, black people wanted more. Financial freedom and escape from the relentless grip of Jim Crow. Realities they couldn't reap from the soil of the South. They boarded trains with their hopes and dreams. Tens of thousands headed to Chicago. And social workers from Olivet Baptist Church greeted them at the 12th Street train platform. They'd help figure out what people needed and point them in the right direction.
The church begins to think about what I call community-minded ministry. What can the church do to help integrate them into this new existence that they're facing?
That's Olivet's current pastor, John A. Smith. The church is located in Bronzeville. A century ago, it was known as the Black Belt, connecting neighborhoods that restricted where black people could live in Chicago. Due to racism and discrimination, the church was all the black community had to get their needs met.
And so when they would come to Olivet, they knew that they could receive housing services, health services. There was a daycare here. First kindergarten in the city came from Olivet.
Olivet represented how churches could exist outside their limestone walls and stained glass windows. Princeton University professor Wallace Bess specializes in African American studies and religion. He says the church is a place of faith and action.
It was a place that was geared to the material needs of black people because it actually felt that that was the work of the church. The church is a place of action. It is a place of work.
Because Olivet did their work so well, Bess says its membership swelled to well over 10,000. He says the future of a church depended on its work in the community.
Churches, they lived or died because Olivet was one of the many churches that said, look, something is happening here. Folks are coming up from the South. They're bringing their needs with them, and we have to address that. If we don't, we would render ourselves irrelevant.
Olivet's growth made it the largest Protestant church in the world at the time, some say. Nearly 40 years later, Olivet still captured the hearts and souls of black migrants. Irene Napier is 93 years old and has been a member of Olivet for 73 years. Before officially moving to Chicago in 1952, she visited her older sister, Tilly, who had already settled here. During her first visit, she was taken aback when she entered the church's doors.
I was overwhelmed because it was so huge and seeing the mass of humanity. I'll never forget that.
In 1953, Ms. Napier finally settled in Chicago. It was almost destined that she become a member of Olivet. Her sister boarded at a home that was owned by Olivet members, and two of her aunts were members of the church. Not only has the church been hers, but also that of her children.
And down through the years, I have been very committed at Olivet. I got married here. My two children, boy and a girl, were raised and baptized here.
Today, she is one of Olivet's 100 consistent members, a far cry from the thousands that once called the church home. Between political differences and housing insecurity, Olivet's membership took a hit. During the Civil Rights Movement, Olivet's pastor, Dr. J.H. Jackson, leaned on more conservative principles.
But many members preferred Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s strategy for racial equity. So they flocked to other churches whose leaders favored a more radical approach. Pastor Smith also says Olivet's membership declined due to dwindling housing options for Black people near the church.
One of the often neglected aspects of why our churches have declined is because of social policy and how housing development influences what goes on around churches.
But he's got a plan to change this. He believes the church can regain its role as a community institution by building Trinity Square. It's a $157 million development with affordable housing, daycare, food pantry, workforce development incubator, and a clinic. Smith says he hopes the project keeps Bronzeville bronze.
One of the goals of Trinity Square is to create affordable housing in our community that will allow the historic community stakeholders to at least have an option to stay.
Ms. Napier believes in Pastor Smith's vision for Trinity Square. She says it is the future of Olivet.
And if I'm given grace to see it and be a part of it, and it's going to come to pass.
Nicole Janine Johnson, WBEZ News.
Governor J.B. Pritzker is calling on Congress to allow for higher blends of ethanol in gasoline year-round as a way to reduce what people are paying at the pump. The governor says moving to E15 year-round would, quote, provide certainty to the market, strengthen rural economies, and reinforce America's commitment to domestic energy production. In an interview with Eric Stock, the Illinois Department of Agriculture Director Jerry Costello says the push for more E15 gas would also provide a lift for corn farmers in the state.
There's two aspects to the situation. Number one, year-round E15. Number one, E15 is about 10 to 40 cents cheaper than regular gas per gallon. Secondly, you've got what's called a winter and a summer blend aspect to E15. Typically speaking, right now is the changeover, roughly March, beginning of April, changeover for the refineries going from a winter to a summer blend. Keeping that winter blend year round is, Gas Buddy would tell you, it's about a 15 cents a gallon difference in the cost of keeping the year round winter blend.
And what would this do to corn prices by making E15 year round?
So it would add demand for another $1.5 billion bushels of corn, approximately 4.5 billion gallons of gasoline. So that would be an increased demand for 1.5 billion bushels of corn and increased demand of 4.5 billion gallons of ethanol.
And the federal government has resisted this because of concerns about smog when the weather gets warmer with this E15 fuel. Is that not a valid concern?
I would say the federal government has resisted this because of the petroleum industry, to be very blunt with you. If you look at E15 and you go from the planting process all the way to the end user, E15 is more environmentally friendly. As a matter of fact, in the state of Illinois, during, while corn is growing, the photosynthesis process, believe it or not, we have more carbon capture going on in the state of Illinois than the entire Amazon rainforest while we're growing crops.
How receptive has Congress been to this since the governor has been making this pitch to Congress for many months now?
So what's interesting is obviously, right now we have a Republican president. Both bodies in Congress are controlled by the Republican Party, the Senate and the House. So they've been verbally receptive, but action has not been taken. And just recently, the Trump administration has said that they would do a waiver through the EPA. They can only do a 20-day waiver. So the waiver that they're talking about would be from May 1st until May 20th, which is literally just a blip, you know, on the calendar as far as 20 days when you're talking about something that should go the entire year.
If they are receptive, what's been the holdup?
As we talked about earlier, I think petroleum community, petroleum manufacturers, refiners, they've been the holdup. And so I can tell you, Congress is saying the right things, but there has not been action. And what Governor Pritzker is calling for, what we are calling for, is action to take place to provide long-term market certainty to farmers and relief at the gas pump for consumers.
That's the Illinois Department of Agriculture Director Jerry Costello. He talked with Eric Stock.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargill.
Give me a Twinkie.
Could you give me a Twinkie?
Just said you'd give me a Twinkie.
Tell him about the Twinkie.
What about the Twinkie?
The Twinkie, America's model junk food. Twinkies were invented on April 6, 1930 at the Continental Banking Company in River Forest, Illinois. Manager James Dewar noticed that the equipment to make the company's small baked strawberry shortcakes sat idle when strawberries were out of season. So he came up with the idea to inject the little yellow cakes with a fluffy white cream filling, and the Twinkie was born. Dewar also came up with the name, inspired by a billboard he once saw for Twinkle Toe Shoes. Twinkie popularity surged after World War II, especially with TV advertising and product placement on kid shows like Howdy Doody.
And kids, Hostess Twinkies are one of the most delicious desserts we've ever had here in Dutyville. And they come two in a package, two big ones.
Twinkies are now so ingrained into society that President Bill Clinton once put one in a time capsule to represent our way of life. And they are referenced in pop culture as often as they are found in kids' lunchboxes.
You get a Twinkies?
I got Twinkies.
Hey, I brought some Twinkies. Anybody want one?
Twinkies?
Twinkies in one? Oh, that's real class, Jan.
A common myth is that Twinkies stay fresh for years. They don't last forever, but they do have a shelf life of about 45 days. Not that they stay on the shelf that long. Americans buy over 500 million of these Illinois-born desserts every year.
Have a Twinkie, snap-ahead.
I'm Clint Cargill, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
Children from low-income backgrounds face nearly a two-year wait to receive dental care in southern Illinois. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin recently visited the future site of the Shawnee Health New Pediatric Dental Facility. The project will allow Shawnee to see nearly 10 times more pediatric dental patients. Brian Sapp explains.
A dental disease and pain for children is so much more. It's sleepless nights, the inability to eat, the inability to concentrate at school or missing school in general.
For the last 10 years, Dr. Scott Beach has provided advanced pediatric dentistry with Shawnee Health. He and his team see around 100 children a month. But Christina Carney, CEO of Shawnee Health, says the need is far greater.
Closer to about 1,000 patients per month that are on a waiting list currently at this point, needing these services, waiting for up to 2 years for oral health care.
A $2.5 million grant from Illinois Children's Healthcare Foundation will help Shawnee reach that goal by renovating and expanding their pediatric dental offices in Marion.
And it took sometimes a year or more for treatment. I could not imagine, as a father and grandfather, a child with a toothache for 4 months or a year. The quality of life for that poor child is going to be terrible because they're constantly distracted by something that should have been fixed a long time ago.
During a visit to the new offices, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin talks about a conversation he had with Carbondale Mayor Carolyn Harvey. She told him how long children from low-income situations have to wait for care. Durbin talked about his efforts trying to help the 2 million Illinoisans who live in communities with a shortage of dentists.
In the last 3 years since I met with Mayor Harvey, we've brought together $9 million for dental services all over downstate Illinois, trying to make sure that we put the money invested in the right kind of treatment and services that can make a difference in the lives of these children and their families.
Carney says this expansion will allow them to provide timely treatment.
If they're in pain, if they're uncomfortable, they are not going to develop in any fashion of life appropriately. So to be able to be a small part of what makes the difference and to be really leading and guiding children to a healthy future is so rewarding.
And this is just one reason why Beach is eager to continue his team's work with the children of Southern Illinois.
This office will be a game changer for the region and what we'll be able to provide. And while this doesn't solve all the problems for access to care, it's a really good step in the right direction, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
The new facility is scheduled to open this fall. Next year, Carney says he'll be able to hire more staff to provide even more pediatric dental care. With WSIU News, I'm Brian Sapp.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.